vamos a continuar una vez inauguradas las jornadas. A mí me gusta pensar siempre qué bien está lo que bien empieza. Y si hemos arrancado pues con una presentación de las jornadas, una inauguración a cargo del presidente de la Comisión de la Competencia, vamos a continuar de una forma realmente brillante con un ponente que es para mí un verdadero motivo de orgullo y de honor poder presentar, como es el profesor Gerber. A mí me gusta pensar a veces pues, que a los que somos de Santiago, pues el apóstol nos echa como manitas, ¿eh?, sin pedirlo de vez en cuando, y debo decirles pues, que este es uno de los casos. Cuando hace muchos meses empezamos a preparar estas jornadas y empezamos, al margen de problemas presupuestarios, a pensar quién nos gustaría traer, al vocal del Consejo de la Competencia, Fernando García Chafeiro, también profesor universitario, y a mí, el primer nombre que se nos vino a los dos a la mente, además fue automático, fue el profesor Gerber. Los dos somos reconocidos admiradores de su obra. Les puedo decir que para mí su libro sobre derecho a la competencia en Europa en el siglo XX, Protegiendo a Prometeus, es posiblemente uno de los mejores, si no el mejor libro, sobre derecho a Europa de la competencia escrito en los últimos 20 años. Desde luego, nadie hace una tesis doctoral en la Universidad de Santiago y en La Coruña sin empezar leyéndose de cabo a rabo el libro del profesor Gerber. Evidentemente, su nombre surgió y a continuación dijimos, vale, estaría muy bien, profesor de la Universidad de Chicago, se ha prodigado mucho en Europa, poco en España, las posibilidades son remotas. Bueno, pues sigue la circunstancia de que días antes de estas jornadas el profesor Gerber estaba en Lisboa impartiendo una conferencia. Unos días más tarde tenía otra conferencia en Italia y tenía justo unos días libres en su paso entre Lisboa e Italia que le permitían, también cierto, gracias a su magnífica disposición, venir a participar en estas jornadas. Ya le digo, suerte, casualidad, apoyo del apóstol, piénsenlo como quieren. La realidad es que tenemos aquí al primer nombre que surgió a la hora de diseñar estas jornadas, a pesar de que parecía realmente difícil que estuviese aquí. Y ya les digo que si admiro la obra del profesor Gerber, es pues porque yo, como tantas personas que nos dedicamos a la libre competencia, nos hemos formado en la tradición europea y estadounidense de esa competencia, hemos estudiado, por supuesto, el Sherman Act, hemos estudiado la obra de conocidos profesores estadounidenses, pero al profesor Gerber hay algo que le distingue. Por ponerles un ejemplo, ha sido el profesor Gerber el que nos ha enseñado a todos los europeos que el derecho a la competencia en Europa no es puro mimetismo con la Sherman Act, sino que tiene un origen propio y distinto que aparece en Austria en el siglo XIX. Bueno, pues el profesor Gerber quien ha tenido que enseñar a los europeos que esto era así. Nadie como él ha escrito sobre el derecho a la competencia en Europa en los años anteriores a la Guerra Mundial. Nadie como él ha escrito sobre la esencia y los fines del derecho comunitario de la competencia. Es decir, el profesor Gerber, a mí me gusta calificarlo como un intelectual del derecho a la competencia. Realmente, mucho de lo que estamos aquí podríamos hablar de forma más o menos brillante sobre el artículo 81, 82, conductas prohibidas. Muy pocos podríamos hablar del origen, del sentido, de la esencia del derecho a la competencia en los términos en los cuales el profesor Gerber puede hacerlo. Buena prueba de ello es su último libro, que lleva por título Competencia Global, Derecho, Mercados y Globalización, en el que analiza el impacto de la globalización en el desarrollo del derecho a la competencia en todo el mundo y del que afortunadamente sí vamos a disponer o disponemos ya de traducción al español, algo que lamentablemente no pasa con su otra obra sobre el derecho a la competencia en Europa en el siglo XX. El profesor Gerber, no voy a aburrirles con su dilatadísimo currículum, es profesor distinguido del Chicago Kent College of Law y sin más preámbulos le cedo la palabra al profesor Gerber. Muchas gracias.
Gracias tanto. Es realmente un honor decir. Es decir, aquí con vosotros, buenos días, señores, señoras, profesores profesionales, estudiantes, público en general. Para mí es un placer dirigirme hoy a ustedes en relación con una materia de gran interés para todos nosotros. Por ello, agradezco a los organizadores de esta conferencia esta magnífica oportunidad. Lamento presentar mi exposición en inglés y no en español. As I mentioned, it is quite sad for me to have to speak to you in English, but maybe one of these days my Spanish will be better. Pardon me for doing that. What I'd like to do is talk with you a little bit about some of the global aspects of competition law, not because we all want to worry about global issues, but because the global issues affect what's going on in Europe. And that's the tie I want to try to make in these few minutes, to try to talk about, in particular, some of the uncertainties in Europe that are caused, in my opinion, right, in my opinion only, by the globalization impulse as it affects Europe. So what I want to try to do is look at some of these uncertainties and try to identify why and how global factors have influenced and are influencing what's going on in Europe, and make a couple of suggestions, perhaps, about what might be done about it. So it seems to me there are three very important uncertainties about competition law in Europe. And these uncertainties, it seems to me, all have serious negative consequences, or at least can have serious negative consequences for the economy, for politics, for the future of Europe. What is the internal uncertainty? What is competition law? What are the contents of competition law in Europe? I think we all know that there are some quite significant differences as to what exactly we mean by competition law. The European Commission has a view, sometimes clearer than others. That is to say, the Director General of Competition has a view. The legal services of the Commission sometimes have a quite different view. The Court of Justice of the European Union has a slightly different view sometimes. Member states operate in ways that are supposed, in some ways, to be consistent with what the Commission says and with what the primary law says at the European level, but not always are they so consistent. I think we know all that. And even within countries such as Spain, there are significant differences, I understand, and I'm not beginning to suggest that I know enough about Spain to speak authoritatively about it, but there are differences with among regions as to how the law is actually applied. So one of the questions is this internal uncertainty. The second is what I call a directional uncertainty, that is to say, in which direction are we going, what is happening in Europe? What are we being driven by? Is it economics? Is it foreign influences? Is it something else? I think it's important to think for a few minutes about these kinds of issues because they affect all of us. And the third of the uncertainties has to do with globalization and how Europe fits with the rest of the world. Right? Obviously, these days, nobody can think about competition law or the economy generally without thinking about how it relates to what else is going on in the world. I just got back from China, some lectures and things in China a couple of weeks ago, and the view of competition law in China and the importance of competition law in China might surprise many of you, and I suspect you might be interested in knowing a little bit about how they're thinking about what competition law does and how important, actually, they think it is. That might surprise you. So those are the three uncertainties I want to talk about: internal uncertainty, directional uncertainty, and where is Europe fit? I want to suggest to you that, in my view, these themes are all interrelated and that they are all based on global factors. The global factors may not be the only cause of them, but they're certainly a significant factor in each one of these uncertainties. It may therefore be important to re-examine some of the things we think we know about competition law in Europe and the world, and I think this might be a good opportunity to do that. So I will try to identify some of the themes, the globalization themes, identify some of the misconceptions that contribute to these uncertainties, provide some perspectives, perhaps, and make some suggestions. The starting point, there was a European model of competition law. The question is there still a European model, and what difference does it make? Couple of issues that just to highlight the differences. What I see happening in Europe is a tendency to forget that there has been a distinctive way of doing competition law in Europe. There is a sense that the economics somehow, the more economic approach, well, it's sort of like what the Americans do, and it's sort of like what maybe some others do, but we really don't know what's European and what's not. It may be useful to think what has been at least the European connection. Some of it is still very important. Not all of it, but some of it. So it seems to me, and I won't go through the book that Paco mentioned, but I think it might be actually quite useful for understanding some of these things. First of all, the basic ideas behind this model that developed over the last 120 years in Europe are two. One is an institutional and procedural one, which says that this is about administrative responses to economic problems. That part is still largely there. It has not changed very much. The issues about procedure and institutional structure are still very much with us. When Mario Monti, whom I understand was in this position last year at this time and probably wishes he still were here rather than in Italy, Mario Monti, when I talked to him some years ago in Brussels, said, if we do not have a procedural component to the modernization, this was probably 10 years ago, if we do not have a procedural component to the modernization, we will be left with a great variety of actual competition laws, even if we have a substantive law at the European level that looks the same, more or less. And he was very concerned about this difference, and he wanted very much to get it through. He was unable to get it through for political reasons, both with the legal services and with member states. So that European vision is that from a practical standpoint, competition law is primarily a matter of administrators, the people who work here, and Paco and others, have the responsibility for responding to economic issues. A very different conception from the American view. A very, very different notion of how competition law should work. The substantive component has always been about protecting a process. From the very beginning, the notion was that we understand that there's a process, and we understand that there are internal relationships within the process. And one of the things that this group of people who we give responsibility for the law, one of the things they're supposed to do is understand that process and reduce, or try to reduce at least, the negative impacts of particular power structures and conduct of affairs. Again, fundamentally different from the American approach to this area. This notion of books and articles that I've written and others talked about this, but it needs really an emphasis because sometimes we think that the American and European approaches are quite similar, and we have to be very careful in making those assumptions. So in general, then, the European approach has always been a pragmatic one, combining responses of administrators to the need for protecting the process of competition. Some of these comments earlier today reinforced those kinds of issues. So that's the basic, as I said, the very, very basic idea. And when we talk about how it evolved, it's important to take just a couple of minutes and remember how it evolved. It was started as a response to economic problems within Europe back 100 years ago. The notion was, we have these economic differences within Europe. Of course, it was not unified in any sense. But the notion was, well, we're beginning to see that there's an economic process even within Europe. And member states, or not member states, but individual countries before there were member states, were trying to figure out, well, how do we relate our economy to the rest of Europe? Right? That was the concept of competition law. It evolved up into the 1920s. It's important to remember that even in the 1920s, Europeans basically thought the American approach to competition law was quite disastrous. There was no sense, if you go back and look at the records, that the Americans had a better approach. In the 1920s, the Europeans were leading the world effort to develop competition law. Right? Again, something that almost everyone forgot after the Second World War. But the concept of competition law that I identified a minute ago was the one that was being pushed on the European level, but also for the globe. This was when Europe was essentially the center of the globe, at least in these ways. With the Second World War, much was forgotten. Much was assumed to be irrelevant. And now the Americans were largely in charge on a global level. But the assumption that, again, Paco mentioned this, the assumption that the U.S. gave the competition law to Europe is simply wrong, as the book pointed out. Some people have never read the book, so they don't know that. But they keep saying, well, there was given that competition law in Europe came from the Americans. Well, that's simply not true. But the whole dynamic did change in the sense that you now had the Americans supporting competition law in Europe, and the main place of support was Germany. But the Americans did not give Germany competition law. Competition law was developed from within Germany during the Nazi period and before, in the underground, people risking their lives and so forth to try to understand how you can make competition law a way of creating, a way of positively structuring a society. That's what this was all about. Remember that the people who were there in the underground, that is to say, not publishing anything, meeting in private, risking losing their lives and their jobs, which some of them did, they did that because they wanted to create something and they wanted competition law to be part of creating that society. So we sometimes think today about competition law as if it were just some technical issue. But the way it was conceived in this European period, in particular in Germany, was this is tremendously important to the society. It's a way of structuring. Some of the issues of economic liberty that were mentioned this morning were critical to the way this was viewed. So Germany gave a great impetus to competition law in Europe, but European competition law is not German by itself, of course. It was a combination of factors, and this combination was energized, let's say, in Brussels. There was an attempt to try to understand how you can do competition law for Europe. Remember, for a long time, the competition law concept was we were using competition law to create Europe. I noticed when I talk to people in Europe these days, sometimes people forget that that was a very important part of competition law's development in Europe. Creating a common market was one of the functions. It was, again, a positive, creative, constructive concept of competition. Just to jump forward for a second as a footnote, when you talk to some of the people in China, not a large number of them, but some of the professors, they're saying exactly the same thing. Competition law can be used to help change the way the society works. End of the footnote on that. back to the European context. So there was a model. It had fairly clear lines. It was based on influence from before the Second World War, on the impact of the German social market economy. If some of you remember the name, the notion that the market was part of society and competition law structured the market and its relation to society. And then the impact, of course, of the European Union. All of that created a strong sense by the early 1990s that there was something very positive in competition law. It was very European, and it was very successful by and large. But there were some problems, right? As Europe was growing, some of the early procedural issues, again, institutional issues, notification requirements, notifying agreements to Brussels, which seemed to make sense in 1958, didn't make sense in 1992 anymore. So everyone became unhappy with certain of the procedural and institutional issues in Europe, and it became clear that with the enlargement to 15, which at that time seemed a big enlargement, there would have to be some procedural changes. The procedural changes started, but what strange things sort of happened was the European Commission. Again, when I talk about the European Commission, I'm referring to the Competition Directorate and the Competition Commissioner, tied institutional and procedural change to substantive change. So that as you, and I detail this in the new book, but as this competition law idea, this modernization was pushed forward on the institutional level, which was the only technically the only thing was happening, the European Commission was also pushing forward a change in a perspective, a different kind, the so-called more economic approach. And we sometimes forget that these two things were very closely tied in getting moved forward within Europe. Initiated a series of rethinkings at the European level. And I want to talk a little bit now about sort of three factors that changed the way Europe and Europeans have thought about competition law. The first is at the European level. And again, I don't think this is too much to say because many of you probably weren't aware of this or have forgotten it. In the 1990s, when the Eastern Europe, when the new member states came in, there was tremendous sense in Brussels, that we have to change the way competition law is done because of the new member states, because they have come from a socialist background. We cannot trust them to just follow the courts because the court identification, the court direction is not clear enough. So maybe it makes sense to think about a more economics-based approach because the economics-based approach is clearer conceptually. And we can control the Eastern Europeans and so forth because we have a clearer concept of what it is. Again, that wasn't a decision based on the problems with the competition law in Europe as such. It was based on a sense of global factors, in this case, European factors. Not only were the new member states about to come in, they took a little longer than some thought, but this, at the same time, two other things were going on. One, there was a fear of European countries losing competitiveness on the global level. Remember that this was globalization decade. And globalization was sweeping across the world, and everyone was saying China and everything was going, and maybe Europe simply can't compete anymore. And there was a sense that, well, the Americans 10 years earlier, 15 years earlier, had reduced the impact of competition law on American enterprises So maybe one of the things that should be done is have a more economic approach, which would assure, at least if applied properly, that competition law didn't go too far and didn't have too much weight on European businesses. And then there was the fact that in the 1990s, the American economy was going quite well. Remember those days. This is a long time ago. At that time, the Europeans were looking across the Atlantic and said, oh, wow, this American approach is great. They're deregulating things. Microsoft is taking over the world, and maybe we have some things to learn from them on the competition law level as well as other levels. And so one of the things that happened in the European Commission was a strong increase in the influence of the American approach to competition law. I'm sure we all know about that part of it. But we may not remember that it was to fit in with these other factors, and that I think is important to remember. So European competitiveness tied with a fear of post-socialist influences in the East that might not be easily controlled, and a sense that the American model might be the right way to go, was a major factor in changing the way the Europeans viewed competition law. I want to take a look for a bit longer, just a few minutes longer, and I certainly don't want to go too long because I know a coffee break is long overdue, but a couple of things about the U.S. model that seem to be forgotten. One of the things I try to do when I speak with a group like this is identify things that I hear in Europe about the American approach that don't seem to really quite have it right. And maybe it's useful to clarify a few things. First of all, again, prior to the 1990s, the European evolution had relatively little to do with the United States. I mean, there were students that would go, leading students would go to the United States and study antitrust law and so forth and so on. But relatively little was looking outside. Again, remember, this was before the modernization. There was each country in Europe had its own competition law. Some people in Brussels paid attention to the United States, but it was relatively minor. All of that changed in a very important way, and it's important. A couple of things about that I want to mention. The U.S. model acquires new influence in the 1990s, it seems to me, for maybe four basic reasons. First, U.S. economic success, which I just mentioned. Right? This was the period during which U.S. economic success seemed very much tied to economic policy. The assumption seemed to be that U.S. economic policy was part of the U.S. economic success. Of course, led to a sense that, well, maybe we should learn something from it. Second, the U.S. government was pushing very hard in lots of places, including Europe, to have a U.S. model of competition law, U.S.-oriented, more economic approach throughout the world. We'll talk in a second about some other factors there. But at least the pressure from the U.S. government was very strong. And remember that the U.S. government people are often very closely tied to law firms, right? You go, you become a, you're in a law firm, and you go to the government, and then you come back to the law firm, or you're an economist, and you go to the, et cetera. So there are very, very close ties there. So that leads to the third point. There were lots of private pressures. This was the time when, after, of course, a long history in Europe and even in the United States to some extent of law firms being relatively small institutions without huge amounts of political power, they were now merging throughout Europe and even on a global basis, European law firms to some extent, but many of them were U.S. law firms. The British, of course, the UK people had a big play in this. So now you were creating creating law firms that were enormous, with enormous amount of resources to try to put pressure to accept a model which, of course, they would lead. Right? And they were going to be the ones who knew about this model, and so they would sell it, right? Essentially on a global level. This was a very attractive idea, and there was a lot of this kind of pressure, this kind of effort going on. In addition, it's important to remember, sometimes people don't, that in the United States, because of the procedural setup, private economists have very large, typically at least, have very large incomes. Not all of them, of course. But private economists dealing with competition law tend to make a lot of money because they advise participants in private litigation. So they were developing this model also, and they were trying to internationalize it for obviously good reasons, right, from their standpoint. Make Europe and everybody else in the world should have this economic approach. And by the way, it will be quite useful for us. My main point is not that that's good, not that it's bad, but that it was a factor in the evolution. Because from that point on, these economic groups were part of the discussion. In Brussels in particular. With regard to the U.S. model, just a couple of points. Some people know these things, some people don't. But one, it's very court-based. Everything is basically centered on the federal courts in the United States. So the kinds of issues that you have in Europe with the administrative control model, they're not absent, but they're very much more minor. Right, they're just not as central. Most everything goes to the courts. Even those aspects of those aspects of public enforcement that we think of, that you think of in we are the you anyway, in Europe, as being simply if I have a decision of a competition authority, I simply have to get it reviewed, and usually it reviewed on administrative grounds. That's not the case in the United States. Everything, even if it's an administrative decision, has to be reviewed by the federal courts as if it were a private litigation along the same standards. So a very different institutional and procedural concept. And again, from the procedural perspective, there is this tremendous private structure. That is to say, adversarial structure where both parties, or if there are more than one, more than two parties, as many parties as there are, control the entire litigation and get all the information. All the judge really has to do is at the end take it all together and make some decisions. It's very different from the European and most other competition law systems in the world. Note that in the U.S. model, the way this tends to work is that almost all the effort is focused on cartels, because if you've got a court making a decision, they want clear answers from the economists, and the best place for getting clear answers from the economists is with cartels. So vertical relationships, dominance, and so forth, they're very hard, and so they have become almost unimportant in the United States. So those I think there's the internal factor which changed the direction of thinking, created uncertainty with what Europe is doing, what is it actually saying. The directional uncertainty for a long time there was for the first period there was a sense that Europe had its own sense of direction. Since the 1990s, a sort of mixed sense. Well, maybe we have to worry about the United States being like the United States being like somebody else. Some serious questions about that. And so what about the rest of the global fit sort of issues? Don't forget that in the 1990s, when globalization hits big and competition throughout the world is much less encumbered, much less restricted by states, competition law becomes a much bigger issue in most places, much bigger issue virtually all over the world. In the United States, it was going the other direction. But in most of the world, competition law is becoming much more important. Budgets for enforcement are greatly increasing. In 1990, if you had four or five really active competition authorities, that would be a lot. By 2000, it was a lot more, and a lot more enforcement was going on. So this created potential for conflict, created increased costs for business. And the first response was, well, let's do this on a cooperative basis. This was the European response. Again, remember that the European Commission first said we're going to respond to those problems by going to the WTO and trying to have a world cooperative arrangement. The Americans did not support that. Some developed countries did not support that. So it looked like the only possibility left was some form of convergence, which would mean at least if there were conflicts, they wouldn't be very substantive conflicts, because if everyone converged on the same model, then the law would be largely similar throughout the world, or at least large parts of the world. And, of course, the assumption was that the only model of convergence, the only place toward which you could converge or would converge, is probably the United States model. There was the sense that the Americans wouldn't change anything, so if we're going to move in that direction, and it would be a clearer model, it would have lots of potential advantages. So this notion that somehow convergence becomes the theme for dealing with competition law on a global level needs to be, I think, needs to be emphasized. And I want to just ask a couple of questions, throw out a couple of questions and make a couple of comments about the convergence issue. I think it is when the European Commission decided that not having been able to go to a cooperative version in the WTO, that convergence was the best way to go, and that following, in a sense, the United States model was perfectly appropriate for Europe, there were some assumptions being made about convergence that are still being made and I think are still discomforting, in the sense that people talk about convergence, some sense that there will be some greater similarity among systems, without thinking at all very clearly about what it means. Convergence really is not just some sense that there's more similarity among some systems. That could mean there are three different countries here that are more similar and five there and so on. So it means everything is supposed to be moving to the same point. And if you ask the question around the world whether that's really happening, well, maybe the laws look sort of the same in some places. In fact, you could, a few of the four major categories of infractions are now in most legal systems. But once you get beyond the surface, there's very little to suggest that that's really happening. In Europe, there's a movement toward more economic approaches, we all know, but it doesn't take into account unilateral conduct to any significant degree, at least not in comparison to the United States. Vertical relations are less important now than they used to be in Europe, but it's not as completely unimportant as it is in the United States. And if you jump across the Pacific, right, from here you could go either way, I guess, go talk in Japan, in Korea, in China, in many other countries that are less developed in competition law. Their main concern is vertical issues. Their main concerns are often abuse of dominance. You go to the developing world, you get a very different picture. What they're worried about typically is controlling big enterprises from Europe, United States, Japan, and now China. They want to use competition law, and as far as they're concerned, it's a very valid use of competition law to control the competition, to control these kinds of big companies. But it's certainly a very different conception than you have in the United States and to a large extent in Europe. If you look at, not that I want to go into the differences right there, but the main point is just to point out that there are quite a few very significant differences in goals, in methods, in institutions. So to talk about large-scale convergence and to base your economic policy, your sense of direction, on a belief that there is widespread convergence requires a lot more thinking than I think most of us have done or anybody has really done. So I'm concerned about that. Let me then just go back to the three uncertainties. and kind of review and put things together. First of all, with regard to internal uncertainty, global factors have led within Europe. Global factors have been responsible for some of the differences between what goes on at the official level in Brussels and what other institutions in Europe, including the European courts, are saying and thinking. In Brussels, there was a great sense of moving towards some external goal, following the U.S. model, following a sense of convergence on some global model. The European institutions in Luxembourg were a little less interested in that kind of impact, and I think it's fair to say they still are. And at the national level, if you look at what happens in various countries in Europe, it's quite clear that in many situations, it's the internal concern that is greater, in the sense that, well, Brussels is doing what it's doing, but you know, maybe they're more focused on something else than what we're focused on. And of course, not always, and at the official level, that's not true. But if you look at what happens at practical level in many countries, that's true. So again, so globalization is a force here. It's changed, moved one part of Europe essentially in one direction, had less of an effect on other parts of Europe, leaving some uncertainty as to just what competition law is doing, what it is, what its contents are. So what about the second kind of uncertainty, directional uncertainty? For a long time, as I mentioned, Europeans thought they knew where to go. That there was a concept of competition law that was led by the European courts that was working pretty well. There were some problems with some institutions that had to be changed, some institutional factors that had to be changed, and clearly that was right. And those factors were changed in 2003, 2004. But there was certainly a notion up until the 1990s that there was a sense of direction. You know, where the European institutions, they're responding to European problems, and it's working pretty well. That is no longer, I think, true, and there is a sense, it seems to me, again, this is just my view of it, that Europeans are not quite sure what direction they're going. Are we going to go and look internally more? Are we going to look to the United States for leadership? Is that what we've chosen because we've chosen the more economic model? Is that really what it is? Is there a sense of global convergence that we should try to follow or try to lead? I think it's, as far as I can see, quite uncertain within Europe just what the role of European competition law, what direction European competition law is going. And the last part, what about the fit of Europe? Again, they're all tied together. What about the fit of between Europe and the rest of the world, including the United States? I'm going to start with just a little story, a very, very short story, from China. The main drafter of the Chinese competition law is a very good friend of mine, and she's been nice enough to show me some letters from Americans and so on about trying to exert pressure on the Chinese. And one of the things she said a few years ago was, you know, it's too bad that Europe looks so much more like the United States now. For a long time, we thought we had two models. We thought we had the U.S. model and the European model. I wanted the European model. The Chinese competition law is largely based on European models. And she said it was very useful to be able to say to the Americans, we've got a concept of competition law. It's based on a European model. And we sort of know where this is going. We don't know exactly how it's going to work in China, but at least we have a sense. And so she said, it's very sad that Europe and the United States now look so similar from some sense. I try then to say it's not so similar, but anyway. And then if you go to places like Latin America, often you hear comments, well, you know, there was a time when we were making our choices about things that there was an identifiable difference between the United States and Europe. And there was, in fact, a period during which there was a lot of the commission would go down to Argentina or Brazil and say, this is the European way of doing it, and the Americans would say, this is the American way of doing it, and there would be kind of conflict. And that's no longer really going on. And it's a loss to some extent from that perspective. From that perspective. And it was some reasons, very good reasons, that we could talk about if you wanted to, why many countries in the world really favored and would still favor, probably in some sense, the European model that once was clear. It's, I think, important to note that because sometimes Europeans forget that this was a role that was played to a very significant extent for quite a while. So when Europe abandons a sort of an independent leadership role, it begins to look like the theory, and some people in Europe have told me this was true in Brussels discussions, and some people have said, well, not really. But the notion seems to be somewhat, well, Europe and the United States together will be the leaders. That may be what happens, but it does certainly mean a loss of leadership role in some sense for Europe, because the European model to some extent, at least the substantive model, is so largely driven by the United States experience. Okay, just a few concluding comments. It seems to me that globalization and responses to it have generated a lot of uncertainty about competition law in Europe. I think there's great value, need to is the wrong word, that there's great value in thinking a little more carefully about just what kind of value competition law can have from the perspective that we've just talked about, both historically and in terms of where we are today, because a sense of competition law that is amorphous, that is no sense of direction, that has no sense that it's part of society, is not likely to be a very influential one. It seems to me that reducing the uncertainties can have great value, can create greater institutional confidence, greater confidence in European and national institutions of competition law, which I think many of you are very interested in. It can create more incentive, at least in some quarters, for investment in Europe. There's now, I think, a sense that competition law, that uncertainties about competition law can also affect competition, can also affect investment. Europe drastically is well, let's put it differently. Europe is very important when it comes to the flow of investment around the world. And some people fear that it's losing some of its attractions. And a clearer sense of perspective on where we are would probably be quite useful. There is a window of opportunity. One of the nice things about one of the valuable things about the structure of leadership in Brussels is that it does change. It does move from one leader to another, one group of leaders to another. The group of leaders that created the more economic approach or generated the more economic approach has now, at least in part, been replaced by others. And so that creates new opportunity for rethinking some things, clarifying some things, and I think it might be useful to do that. So my suggestions, very limited suggestions, but for whatever they're worth. I think it might be very useful to have a clearer sense of what competition law in Europe has been. Sometimes it's very easy to just forget that there's something there, that there's a real sense of what competition law can be. And as I said, it's always been, at least until recently in Europe, a much more constructive concept of competition law than you would find on the other side of the Atlantic. There's never been a sense that competition law was something that created anything in the United States. That wasn't what it did. It may have preserved things in some people's view, but it didn't create the way it has created in Europe. And that is precisely what the rest of the world is looking for, a sense of, well, not the entire rest of the world, some people in these countries don't want to do it that way, but many people who are interested in competition law, interested in economic development, interested in political development, are very concerned about having a concept of competition law that is constructive. And that's what European has certainly been, and maybe worth thinking about that a bit. I think it's terribly important to focus on adapting what has been to where we are now in the world. Obviously, economics has to play a much greater role than it did 20 years ago. But the notion that there is there is one direction for economics or one kind of role for economics overlooks the possibility of being very much more discriminating. Certain kinds of things can be done. For example, in the United States, you've gotten to a position where economics controls not only the construction of factual material, but provides essentially the norms of competition. Most countries don't want to go that far. And even if you have economics, what kind of economics? All of that seems to me can be tied in and related to what European competition law has been about. Third point, I think it's useful to be aware of the kinds of costs that foreign pressures, globalization pressures, can impose. We sometimes fairly lightly take something from someplace else without thinking about, who's pushing this agenda and for what reasons are they pushing this agenda, and what are the costs to us of trying to follow in that direction? These are difficult questions to deal with, but we can deal with them, we can study them, we can identify them, and you know, some of us have tried. But keeping that part of it in mind seems to me as tremendously important. And then and this is the last point on this, being clear about the assumptions that we make about the rest of the world and the fit of Europe with the rest of the world seems to me very important to be constantly analyzing those assumptions. As I suggested, sometimes in Europe we forget that much of the world still thinks that maybe Europeans should, and I notice that I sometimes switch pronouns here, sorry about that, that Europeans really have a lot more to say than sometimes they are saying. So we need to think about some of those assumptions. So I think we can treat this period in Europe as it's a period of stress, obviously. But it also can be a period of experimentation with adapting to the global situation, trying to find ways of building on the past, but building constructively the way it has been done before, now just in a different set of circumstances. So quiero darles gracias por la su atención.
Realmente, gracias, profesor Gerber. Thank you very much. Es una satisfacción para quien presenta un ponente ver que el ponente, pues en 50 minutos, le deja quedar tan bien y demuestra con su ponencia que todo lo que dije sobre él es cierto. Nos ha demostrado que, evidentemente, pues un auténtico intelectual del derecho a la competencia. Nos ha enseñado que una conferencia sobre derecho a la competencia puede ser amena e intelectualmente estimulante por la cantidad de temas que ponen en conexión, y aunque es la hora de la pausa para el café, pues si quieren tenemos tiempo a hacer alguna pregunta.
Thank you very much for your speech. It was really interesting. Only two questions. One, what do you think about, do you think that there exists a different approach, antitrust approach, in the United States and the European Union, linked to the crisis situation in the last 4 years? May you make a comparison between the answer of the politics and also authorities in the United States and European Union in this crisis context? And second question, one of the problems of private enforcement in Europe are always the aversion to the triple damages. The aversion, the European aversion to triple damages. And what do you think about this? Is that something that may change in future or not?
Thank you for the question. A very good question. Probably deserves about a 20-minute answer, but I think I shouldn't give it a 20-minute answer. In short, with respect to the comparison during the last 4 years, when President Obama took office, he promised to do more on the competition level, on the antitrust level. And he appointed people to the Department of Justice that he thought would do that. And some of them wished to do that. But the politics of the period have prevented very much activity at the federal level. So it's fair to say, I think, that the public enforcement has been much less than probably President Obama would like, but the pressures from business and so forth not to engage in these things, not to engage in antitrust actions, have been quite strong. Again, remember that in the U.S. that's only a part of the picture, that private enforcement is a critical factor. And from private enforcement, it's not really so much the last few years as a policy matter, but the fact that the competition law at the private level has become so extraordinarily expensive in the United States. It is almost impossible to have a competition case, private antitrust case, without expecting an enormous amount of cost, because you have to now get economists on all kinds of levels, and it just becomes extremely expensive. So the firms, whether because of the crisis or not, maybe to some extent, yes, but are becoming much less likely to go to court on private cases. It's also the notion that economics would clarify outcomes, and that was the idea for a while, has now been increasingly thrown into some, state of uncertainty. Conceptually, economics clarifies things, but outcomes, it turns out, doesn't necessarily clarify things so much. And so many, many companies are saying, it's just too uncertain what's going to happen. They have to measure all of these things on an economic basis, and it's very unclear, and it's going to cost a tremendous amount of money. So that part of enforcement has fallen off as well, but not necessarily because of the crisis of the last 4 years, in some part, but only, I think, in some part. Again, don't forget that the European officials, that those of you who are officials here, have much greater responsibility than the Americans do. The Americans are just one part of it, and you have to go to court anyway, and they do the main decision. The main legal and political justification is at the court level rather than the administrative level in the United States. So in a sense, you have a much greater responsibility than the Americans do. As to travel damages, I think I understood the question, but if I didn't, please excuse me. In order to encourage more private enforcement, it's probably in Europe, it's probably travel damages would obviously be useful, but it seems to me that there are lots of other obstacles that are very, very great. You've got essentially judges in Europe, around Europe, a couple of exceptions in the UK and Ireland and so forth. But most of Europe, where the idea of having to put together a competition law a case, I mean, it's not like the United States where you go and you get, you know, each side makes its case and it creates the whole thing and puts it all together and then the judge just sort of makes a decision. The European, in Europe, by the way, also in China and Japan and Korea and so forth, the judge has to make the case and get all the European, get all the economic material. Somebody's got to pay for that in the United States. The American plaintiffs, defendants pay for it, but in the European context, it has to be paid for by the state. The state doesn't really want to do that. So the treble damage issue, undoubtedly, would help encourage things. But I think you'd still have lots of significant obstacles. Did I get the answer? I mean, was that the right question?
Bueno, les pediría que cuando hagan una pregunta se identifiquen para que vayamos todos conociéndonos. Profesor Marcos, por favor.
Yes, this is Francisco Marcos from IE Law School. I have a brief institutional question for Professor Gerber. You haven't mentioned this, as you know. This is the your keynote speech is part of this meeting of regional and state authorities in Spain. And I wonder whether you could say something about the relationship between federal and state enforcement in the U.S. and whether there could be any learning there for us, because, as you know, and as the president of the National Competition Commission mentioned before, the system here is quite young, and it seems to be working, but I don't know if you could say something about state antitrust enforcement in the U.S. that could be of use here. Thanks.
Yeah, it's, again, a very useful question that maybe this one maybe should have 15 minutes response, but I'll do it in three or two or less. One way to answer the question would be a very sort of flip answer, a very sort of quick answer that there's almost no relationship, right? I mean, in one sense, there's no. It's not related in the sense that it's related in Spain, right? You don't have a structure which says there's a national authority and then the regional authorities which somehow are part of the same structure and somehow, pardon my lack of knowledge about Spain in this context, but in which there's at least a fairly clear sense of how they're supposed to operate together. In the United States, you have most antitrust enforcement, and I know you know these things, basically federal enforcement, but a few states, if they think it's worth it, will take some actions in certain kinds of cases. If the federal government is losing its interest in competition law and antitrust enforcement, sometimes this will provoke a particular state. Probably the most active historically has been New York. But even there, it provokes it to some sort of response, maybe a little bit more enforcement than you had otherwise. But it's not coordinated in any sense. There's no sense in which the things are fitting together in some sort of system. So it's a little hard for me to see a clear relationship other than this particular one. That is to say, if for political or other reasons, enforcement becomes difficult at the national level, then if you want to have enforcement, it may have to be at the regional level. And there's a lot to be said for encouraging that under those circumstances. But in the United States, I don't think you have much direct to learn other than that relationship.
Thank you so much, David, for your speech. I have one idea that you expressed in your conference that I cannot agree most, is that probably Europe is trying to find out where Europe fit in the global world. I think it's not only in antitrust, it's in everything. We are trying to find out where we are now. But as to the conference, let me ask you just two little things. Well, we know that the American influence is on dominant at the moment, and what role do you think has played American universities? Because I know that if you go to study to America, you realize that you get people studying from everywhere in the world, many from Asia. So these guys come back to their countries, start working, and in a few time they become authorities, lawyers, and you teach antitrust law very well. So they apply what they have learned. So this is maybe a factor that should be also considered in this American influence. And also my second question is, also if you go to Latin America, for instance, you still find interest on the European model, as you said. And also can be a question of time, because they are now like we used to be like 20 years ago, and they are creating an internal market. So maybe for them, vertical restraints are a big issue, as it used to be for us in the past. So maybe the answer for the problems are not in American model, but in the European model in the past. Just two reflections, please, 5 minutes, sorry.
No, those are, again, very good reflections, very useful reflections. As to the influence of U.S. law schools, no doubt there is a significant influence. One aspect of it is on the surface. That is to say, somebody learns something and they go back and may or may not apply it in some sense. Another one is a more subtle point, I think. If I come from, let's say, let's choose Peru in Latin America, and I go to get a PhD at Harvard, I get my PhD, I want everybody to know about it back in Peru, right? And so I want to keep my connections to all the other people that were there and teaching in Harvard or Chicago or wherever it might be. And so there's a sense of, well, yes, there's kind of a pressure, a social pressure to pursue at least the basic kinds of economic approaches that are common in the United States. I think that is a very important factor. Some countries are much more insistent on relating that to their national circumstances than others. In the new countries, as you mentioned, in Latin America and so forth, they had competition laws for a long time, they just never paid any attention to them. They tend to be much more willing to sort of try to take a lot of this and just apply it the way they learned it in the United States. Again, these are basically, not always, but often economists, not necessarily the law people. But they get these positions in the competition authorities in Latin America. If you go to Japan or Korea or China, you'll get people who've studied competition law as well as economics in the United States, but they're much more cautious. They're much more aware. We are just different. We are different. We see some value in how the Americans do this. I mean, I think we've all learned that more certain uses of economics are really very valuable. Sometimes it's a question of whether you can afford them or not. But we need now to distinguish what kinds of uses, and I think that's where the future of the next 10 or 15 years are going to be. Which kinds of economics are we using for what purposes should be the question, or a question. So you go to China, or as I say, or Japan or Korea and some of the other ones. Well, we just know that we're very different. And so we're not going to try to apply it directly. We'll just, maybe there's some use for it, and we'll take it, but it doesn't have the same impact. So differential impacts, but certainly impacts. So that's the U.S. law school's part. The part about, the second question was more about, tell me again, just what?
It was a question of when they are integrating their markets, maybe if they have...
Oh, yes, right. The point, I think, is a very good one, that it was the older European model that was and is actually attractive to lots of developing countries. And not just because of the model. The model is often only understood at a fairly superficial level. To ask them about it, well, we sort of get the basic idea, right, but maybe not very much more than that. But because it institutionally fits. Right, because you can do things in Africa or Southeast Asia or to some extent in East Asia that tie into European institutional procedures and institutional patterns and that don't fit at all with the American model of institutions. So yes, I think that's right, that the older European model in terms of substance and even the current European model in terms of institutions and procedures, those are the things that are attractive in a lot of developing countries.
¿Alguna pregunta más? Una última pregunta.
Sí, Sergio Baches. I have a couple of questions for you. One of them is pretty forward.
It's pretty what?
It's a direct question, a straight question. On your view, do you think that... without taking into account cultural differences, do you think a court-based enforcement approach is better than a purely administrative enforcement approach?
No.
No. And the second question, you've talked about...
Which I mean, I can tell you more if you want.
The second, I'll put the second question on you. You've talked about the constructive role of competition law in the what was the European community, and that role we cannot find it in the U.S. It's also interesting to think about the destructive role that sometimes legislators and public administrations have on competition law. There's a huge debate, especially in this country, about those regulations or attitudes by the public administrations which are stifling or freezing competition. And I wonder whether you have perceived in the U.S. the same debate. I mean, for instance, the public administration freezing competition by issuing unfair public procurement rules, for instance, or setting up entry barriers in certain markets for potential competitors.
As to the last question, there have been certainly wouldn't be a debate such as the one I think is going on in much of Europe and certainly in Spain. There have been sort of isolated small responses in particular areas, but it hasn't been understood as part of antitrust law. Right? You might put something in with regard to procurement, not understood in the United States way of thinking about this as part of antitrust law at all. State aid kinds of issues are, of course, not understood as part of competition law and antitrust law in the United States. So yes, there have been some things like that, some factors that would influence market access and look a little bit protectionist, or maybe more than a little bit protectionist. But they certainly haven't been understood as competition law issues. The only thing that we can say, I think, about from the competition law standpoint is what we talked about, the antitrust law standpoint, is what we talked about before. That is to say that the government, the federal authorities, which basically the Department of Justice for this purpose, has gotten a lot of pressure not to enforce too much, and really relatively little has happened. And that's pretty clearly a response to the crisis, global crisis. But the other things are not understood really as antitrust sorts of issues. And just, I didn't mean to be answer with one word only, but I wanted to make, I guess, I did, was a one word, could answer the question. I don't think it's really very useful to try to think in terms of changing entire ways of doing competition law and making it entirely court-based things, because you would have to change so much within the system. Such a tremendous... The difference between the way the American system works and the way the European system works at the court level between the United States and virtually all other countries in the world, by the way, is they're just enormous differences. And you would have to make such great changes that anything that would move toward the American role of courts strikes me as almost impossible to imagine. On the other hand, and this is try to be a little less flippant about the response, there may be ways of increasing the role of Europe of courts in Europe that would be very useful. That is to say, not necessarily trying to follow the American model and just making it a pure court-based model, because I think that's just very hard to imagine. But increasing the role of courts, giving more responsibility. I know that that the European Commission and many European countries have training sessions for judges, and they've been of some help. That would be one factor. But other factors such as increasing the substantive content of review. I mean, I don't know what the situation is in Spain, but one of the big issues about court control, not necessarily about private enforcement, but court centrism, one of the factors in the U.S. that's been so critical has been that basically everything has to go through the same set of courts and the same reasoning. And for good or bad, right? I mean, some people say that's negative in some ways. But at least it gives a sense of unity to the law, gives a sense of predictability, at least to a certain extent, and at least you have a source of political legitimacy that sometimes is difficult to achieve without referring to independent courts.